Iran summons envoys of Germany and France to protest the EU's and Paris' condemnation of the execution of an Iranian convicted of spying. The British Prime Minister says the UK and the EU remain very far apart on key issues in Brexit trade talks, and people should be ready for a no deal. And Germany says it will go into a partial lockdown from Wednesday as Europe's biggest economy battles a surge in coronavirus infections. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran has summoned the French ambassador to Tehran over a statement released by Paris concerning the execution of an anti-Islamic Republic figure. The Iranian Foreign Ministry protested this statement that had denounced the execution of Ruhollah Zam. He was the administrator of the anti-Iran telegram channel, Ahmad News. Well, the French envoy said he would relay the protest to his country's officials. Earlier, Tehran also summoned the German ambassador after a similar statement by the EU. Germany currently holds the EU rotating presidency. Ruhollah Zam was executed after being convicted of acting against Iran's internal and external security. He was also convicted of spying for French intelligence agencies and desecrating Islamic sanctities. Happy to welcome to the program Syed Mohammad Marandi, university professor and political analyst out of the University of Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, once again, we're seeing actually someone who had been convicted of working against the Islamic Republic of Iran, and we once again are seeing those outside of the country actually trying to condemn Iran for executing someone who basically was a spy and working against the interests. Your take on this, this time around, of course, we're talking about the France and Germany, but this is not something rare in general when Iran decides to carry out various judicial sentences.
As you pointed out, he was working for French intelligence, and this is not something that came out after he was arrested. This is something that he had said openly to his friends when he was in France. He was being protected by French intelligence, and he was working for French intelligence, and he was very proud of the fact that they gave him a great deal of protection. A documentary came out in Iran months before he was arrested, and it was clear for everyone to see. So this is no accusation, or this is nothing that was discovered after he was arrested or through secret exchanges. This is something that he was open about. So someone who works for foreign intelligence is a spy. And then the issue is not what he was doing as a journalist. The issue was not having a media outlet. The issue was that he used that media outlet to teach people how to make bombs, and he gave them targets. He told them where to use those weapons. It was so bad that the Telegram channel removed, the Telegram social media outlet removed his channel because he was violating its regulations and advocating violence. Mm. So someone who is a spy, works for a foreign intelligence agency, who advocates violence, who teaches people how to carry out violence, and who gives targets for people to go out and use violence against, obviously he's not going to be treated as some sort of ordinary criminal. And we have to also add the fact that the EU and France and Germany, they condemned the execution of this spy, but they did not use the word condemnation for the murder, for the terror attack, for the assassination of Dr. Fakhrizadeh just a couple of weeks ago. So an innocent person who was murdered through an act of terrorism, This person was killed, and there was no condemnation, yet this other person who was a spy, advocated violence, his execution was condemned.
And with what you've said, how you described it, I mean, basically they would, if there was an individual acting as such against them, they would probably label this individual not only a spy but a terrorist because, of course, of showing the techniques of how to make incendiary devices. Yet we have the Amnesty International basically saying the execution of journalist Ruhollah Azzam is a deadly blow to freedom of expression. Your take on how it is defined, for example, an individual that you just described of some of the acts that he engaged in, but an entity like Amnesty International is describing him as a journalist and his execution as a deadly blow to freedom of expression.
Well, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other such organizations are funded by Western powers and by very powerful people in the Western establishment. So obviously they are going to attack those countries and focus on countries that are beyond the sphere of the influence of Europe and North America. Amnesty International, if it's very concerned, it should go out right now and seek those people who gave Saddam Hussein chemical weapons to use to kill tens of thousands of Iranians. Amnesty International, if it's so concerned, it should go and have call for the arrests of Western leaders, Canadian, American, French, and British leaders who are giving Saudi Arabia weapons to use to carry out the genocide in Yemen. Obviously, these sort of arguments are not seen as legitimate or sincere. This person, there is video evidence of him telling his friend that he has the protection of French intelligence, that he is an important person for them, he is an important asset for them. And as I said, Telegram itself, the CEO of Telegram, tweeted that we shut down his channel because he was advocating violence. He was teaching people how to make bombs and where to use those bombs. So a person who's working for a foreign entity and carrying out violence against his own country, he's not a journalist. And by trying to make him appear to be a journalist, Amnesty International is doing a major disservice to those sincere journalists who are actually working hard to get their job done.
Syed Mohammed Marandi, thanks so much for being with us, university professor and political analyst right here out of Tehran. Iran's deputy foreign minister says Tehran supports peace in Afghanistan, but suspects the U.S. has hidden intentions, despite its push for peace talks between Kabul and the Taliban.
We support peace and its restoration in Afghanistan, but we do not trust the U.S. intent. In different times and circumstances, Americans have proved they're not trustworthy and that one cannot be optimistic about them. Therefore, we advise our friends in Afghanistan to be wary of the ill intent of certain countries, especially the U.S.
Anakchi, who is visiting Kabul to finalize a strategic Iran-Afghan partnership, said Tehran believes Afghans should themselves decide how to advance their peace talks. He rejected outside interference in Afghanistan, but said any country willing to help bring peace there should be welcomed. Araghchi further stressed that the Taliban militant group is a reality of Afghan political landscape, and ignoring it will lead to continued conflict and bloodshed. He said the Taliban and the government should reach a peace settlement that benefits all Afghans. The Afghan Defense Ministry says dozens of Taliban militants have been killed in fierce overnight fighting with government forces in southern Kandahar province. In a statement, the ministry said Afghan forces launched air and ground assaults after the militants attacked checkpoints in five districts surrounding the city of Kandahar. It added that over 50 militants were killed and 9 others wounded. The Taliban have not reacted to the fighting that reportedly lasted for several hours. Over the past few days, the militant group has launched several attacks in Kandahar. That despite an ongoing peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government in Doha. Moving on to other news this hour, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says his country and the European Union remain divided on key issues in their post-Brexit trade talks. Now, Johnson says his people should be ready for no deal on December the 31st. That's when a deadline to reach a deal expires. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue. Let's take a listen. And now it's time for this hour's news review. Well, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson says a no-deal scenario in post-Brexit trade talks with the EU is the most likely outcome.
As things stand, and this was basically what Ursula and I agreed, I'm afraid we're still very far apart on some key things. But where there's life, there's hope. We're going to keep talking to see what we can do. But I've got to repeat, the most likely thing now is, of course, that we have to get ready for WTO terms, Australia terms. And don't forget, everybody, we've made huge preparations for this. We've now been at this for 4.5 years.
Johnson was speaking with reporters after a phone conversation with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. The two leaders discussed major unresolved topics, and they agreed to push on with talks despite the passing of a self-imposed deadline on Sunday. The negotiations have been ongoing for months now without any breakthrough. The thorniest issues are fishing rights, fair competition, and finding ways to settle disputes. Britain left the EU back in January. Now, transition period is now in place that will expire at the end of December. That's also the deadline for reaching a post-Brexit trade deal. Well, let's cross over to London. I'd like to welcome my first guest, Amina Taylor. Amina, thanks so much for being with us. First of all, well, let's talk about, because on the one hand, it was said that there was a deadline, and today was the deadline, and now they're saying that there is not a deadline. So now that they're changing this deadline, does it mean that we can go up to the 31st? Can it go now past the 31st, or are there certain legalities that have to be taken care of prior to January the 1st?
Well, the legalities, Martin, good to speak with you. It's always been about Britain's determination that Brexit didn't drag on as they saw it. So when the people voted in 2016, they wanted to be very, very quickly that, quote unquote, Britain regained its sovereignty. So they didn't want this to be the usual negotiations without an end. So a lot of this is about Britain's Conservative Party's desire to see this done with an end date. All parliaments need to ratify this, so not just the British Parliament, but that of the other 27 member states when there is a deal that Ursula von der Leyen and Michel Barnier, they go back and say, listen, this is what we've cooked up, what do you think? But it's normally with the idea that once the deal's been done, it's a fait accompli in terms of the other parliament. But the fact that it's moving and moving and moving, I think should have been something that would have always been in the back of their minds. And I think when we had conversations about British Navy vessels being prepared to board and a lot of that kind of hardcore rhetoric we were getting yesterday, I think that was kind of to say, listen, guys, we're still on it. But be prepared that we're in these back rooms really negotiating hard for British rights, when I think more seasoned observers, perhaps even yourself amongst them, Marzia, would have known that if they were even close to getting something, they could just move that the old lever on the timetable there with very few repercussions.
Right, right. Well, let me get our other guests in here. I mean, out of Brussels, Paolo Rapone, Secretary General CIPI Foundation. Thanks so much for being with us. Your take on all this, and from the EU perspective, we've been hearing for a while now as far as the deadlines, and the deadlines have been moved. And as you heard our guests out of London, or our correspondent out of London, Amina, saying basically these were self-imposed deadlines. But what is at stake here? We heard a lot of harsh words yesterday coming out of London and talking about even boarding EU vessels and arresting individuals. So where does it really stand in your perspective right now?
Well, it stands where it was, basically. It is a confrontation between a country that has been a member state and has decided to regain its sovereignty in full, and an organization that doesn't have the same qualifications of sovereignty and therefore opposes procedures. And the game between sovereignty on the UK side and procedures on the EU side brings us to this sort of surreal deadlock in which we are living.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on this news review. Amina Taylor, correspondent out of London, always a pleasure talking to you. And Paolo Ravoni, Secretary General, CIPI Foundation, out of Brussels. Well, Germany is set to enter a new lockdown on Wednesday to contain a surge in daily coronavirus infections and fatalities. The new lockdown will remain in place until January the 10th. Under the restrictions, non-essential shops and schools will close. Gatherings will be banned over the New Year holiday. Companies have also been urged to allow employees to work from home or offer extended holidays. The German chancellor says the measures are needed to stop an exponential growth in coronavirus cases.
After a period in which we couldn't stop the exponential growth and had a sideways movement, we have had rising case numbers and exponential growth again for a few days. This means that we also have a lot of deaths. You all follow the statistics, and we know that the health system is already under great strain, and our intention has always been to avoid a strain on the health system. That is why there is an urgent need for action.
Merkel added that the coronavirus situation has become out of control in Germany. On Sunday, the country reported more than 20,000 new infections and over 300 new deaths in 24 hours. Other countries across Europe are also struggling with a surge in COVID cases and fatalities. The Netherlands reported nearly 10,000 new infections on Sunday. Russia registered nearly 500 new deaths. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has urged a Moroccan parliament to criminalize the normalization of ties between Rabat and Tel Aviv.
We call on the Moroccan parliament to criminalize the normalization with the Zionist occupation, enact the necessary laws to do so, and fight all its forms that only serve the interests of the enemy, no matter what the justifications or the price of these deals were.
The Hamas official condemned the normalization deal brokered by the U.S. He said the agreement contradicts the authenticity of Morocco and its people who support the Palestinian cause. Al-Zahar said the deal is a stab in the back of Palestinians and a reward for Israel. Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip also denounced the normalization deal between Morocco and Israel.
Normalization leads to the destruction of the Palestinian cause, an increase in the number of settlements, and the strengthening of the word Israel, meaning it gives it more strength to commit crimes against the Palestinians.
U.S. President Donald Trump announced a normalization agreement on Thursday. He said Rabat and Tel Aviv had agreed to full diplomatic relations, calling the move a historic breakthrough. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also called the deal historic. The move drew criticism from some Moroccan factions. Morocco is the fourth Arab state to normalize ties with Israel since August, after Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan. And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
the limelight.
The New Jersey-based climate research organization, Climate Central, released a study on Tuesday, December 1st, showing that 7,668 houses, townhomes, and apartments that are either in low-income areas or are subsidized affordable housing units are currently exposed to at least one coastal flood risk event per year, and that number is expected to triple by 2050 if fossil fuel emissions are not dramatically reduced in the coming years. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Without Climate Action, Number of Low-Income Homes Affected by Flooding Projected to Triple by 2050, study shows. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Climate scientists have warned for years that millions of people living in coastal areas will be increasingly vulnerable to flooding in the coming decades, one of the many risks of policymakers failing to confront the climate crisis. But a new study details how people in low-income housing are expected to face the most drastic consequences of inaction. The New Jersey-based climate research organization, Climate Central, released a study on Tuesday, December 1st, showing that 7,668 houses, townhomes, and apartments that are either in low-income areas or are subsidized affordable housing units are currently exposed to at least one coastal flood risk event per year, and that number is expected to triple by 2050 if fossil fuel emissions are not dramatically reduced in the coming years. Analyzing maps of affordable housing across the U.S., researchers found that homes in New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, and California are particularly at risk for flooding damage brought on by hurricanes and sea level rise. A rising tide lifts all boats is a phrase often used to articulate the idea that a prosperous economy will benefit all its participants, wrote Climate Central. But the rising tides, driven by global warming, are increasing flood threats for thousands of residents in low-income communities and neighborhoods. Flooding can wreak havoc on buildings and the residents who live in them, threatening public health and causing profound disruption to families struggling to make ends meet. Chronic or nuisance flooding can also damage cars and keep residents from getting to work, school, or medical care. Middle and high-income households are expected to be affected by flooding in the coming decades as well. But Climate Central noted that people living in affordable housing are more likely to be adversely affected, as affordable housing tends to be older and is rarely equipped with resilience-enhancing features such as flood-proofing, grid energy, or backwater valves due to the cost of such measures. Additionally, residents of affordable housing often lack the financial resources to repair, rebuild, or retreat from their housing after it is damaged by floodwaters, the group said. Flood-damaged affordable housing can have long-term consequences for residents, owners, and communities, including increased homelessness, loss of rental income that can make it difficult for housing owners to provide affordable housing, and neighborhood-level economic downturns. The study demonstrated that climate action is always a justice issue first, tweeted 350.org co-founder Bill McGibbon. We don't train our attention on these neighborhoods, but many of them are already suffering significantly from these problems. Benjamin Strauss, chief executive and chief scientist of Climate Central, told The Guardian. Since 1880, the mean sea level worldwide has climbed by about 8 inches. The rise has accelerated in some U.S. cities in the last century, increasing by about 1 foot. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, warned in a report in August that by the end of the century, the global sea level could rise more than 8 feet above 2000 levels if world governments don't take urgent action to reduce planet heating greenhouse gas emissions. Last month, scientists were startled to observe that a huge swath of Arctic sea ice in Siberia had yet to begin freezing for the year, among the latest signs that policymakers are not doing enough to rapidly reduce emissions. Climate Central's study served as a reminder that major climate-related events like hurricanes aren't the only challenges we need to consider, tweeted Sarah Stanley, Director of Communications at the U.S. Green Building Council. The quieter threat of sea level rise is already crippling communities, particularly the underserved.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena? And how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. Countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard. The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured, will revive and will prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the U.S., and in the end, the U.S. won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S. as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well, and if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others? I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. the national crisis shook the trust in currency. And the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the US dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the UK and then the US, reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the US and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the US would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly, that makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, then I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the U.K. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the U.S. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back, or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years, and humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline, and as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week, but join me again here next time on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.